Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. My guest today is Granville Weiss Burgess. Grew up in Greenville, native Greenvillian. He now lives in Connecticut. And our conversation is coming via Connecticut Public Radio based out of Hartford, Connecticut. And we're going to be talking about his latest work. He's done a lot of writing, including South Carolina screenplays, novels. And this is a novel entitled The Last at Bat of Shoeless Joe. And with that, Granville, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here, Walter.
Let's talk about how did a boy from Greenville, South Carolina, end up writing for soap operas, and you're living in Greenwich, Connecticut, although you do have a place in the mountains, right?
We do, yeah, just near Caesar's Head.
Okay. But how did you get from playing Lions Club baseball in Greenville to where you are now?
Well, my father was a lawyer in Greenville, Weiss Burgess Freeman and Parham. It's now called the Weiss Law Firm. He thought maybe I need to get my sons a better education than they're going to get here. Of course, in those days, it wasn't thinking of the daughters. So he asked around, and my mother knew someone who worked for a Shell Oil Company, and she said, where should we send our sons off to school? And he said, oh, Phillips Exeter Academy. I've been in the North ever since, trying to get my way back home, but I haven't managed it yet. So that's the short version of how I ended up North.
Well, I'm going to extend it. After Phillips Exeter, where did you go to college?
I went to Princeton University, and I majored in history. And that's where I first got interested in the theater, because I was in the Triangle Club. I don't know if your listeners know much about it, but we do original musical comedies, and Jimmy Stewart is probably our most famous graduate, and followed by many others like Joshua Logan, but also Brooke Shields, for instance, et cetera. But so that's where I got the theater bug. And after that, I was an actor. I was president of Triangle, and one of my proudest achievements is we put the first woman ever on the Triangle stage the year I was president. So, and she was a Chinese American to boot, so I've always been extremely happy about that. My mentor at the time said, if you want to be an actor, you should go to New York City and find out if you like the life of an actor. And so I did, and I didn't. I mean, a lot of cattle calls and, you know, just standing in line. I didn't even have a union card. I think what did it for me was one day I managed to be the assistant, an intern with a director who was directing a Broadway show. And so the union required that you see every union actor over a 3-day period. It's called an open call. So I sat with him behind the desk for 3 days while all these actors came in and handed over their resume and picture and talked for 30 seconds or a minute if they were lucky, and then next. And then all of the while, what they didn't know was the show was already completely cast and they were just looking for 2 understudies. So I said, man, the odds of this are not great, and I don't love it that much, so I think I'll just abandon the dream of being an actor at this moment. So then I took a hippie drive in a VW van, which I guess was de rigueur in those days, out to California. But I came back to Boston, but I couldn't get theater out of my blood, as it were. So I started writing drama reviews for the newspaper, and then I went and did summer stock, and the music director there said, you know, you should go to Catholic University of America and get an MFA in directing. So I did do that. So, and all the time I was there, in fact, that summer I did my first writing. I adapted Winnie the Pooh for the summer program and wrote music lyrics to some of their songs. And then while I was in grad school, I continued to do that. So I've always been interested in children's theater. And I've written a lot of children's musicals and plays. In fact, I have a nonprofit called Quill Entertainment Company, and our mission is teaching America's heritage through story and song.
All right. Let's take a segue into that and then get back to your career. I saw that in your bio. as a historian, one of the things, difficult things today is how to get the story of our country across to the younger generation.
Absolutely. That was our mission. And I was reading and, you know, still read all these statistics about how little history our younger generation knows. So that was basically what we wanted to do. We wanted to bring history to life. You know, we would tour it to schools, and we would have songs like Everybody's Watching was the one about the making of the Constitution. And we had, you know, study guides that went along with it, and it was very successful. I mean, it works. You can get kids interested in history by entertaining them. As I said, I majored in history at Princeton, so that's always been a passion of mine, how to blend history and dramatic writing on the stage.
So this is just in Connecticut where your Quill Entertainment works? Or?
It was founded in Philadelphia when I lived there, and then we've done shows in New York City, of course, and in Connecticut and Massachusetts, sort of in the Northeast.
Well, when young teenagers today can sing every song from Hamilton.
Yes.
There's a message for history professors out there somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, Hamilton is a great example of the passion that kids can bring to history and learning it. My current dramatic writing project is called Common Ground, and it's about Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, again, it's trying to educate as we entertain, but, you know, how the basic thesis is if these two unlikely people could become friends, a former slave and a president can become friends and find common ground, then everybody can. So that's what there's always, in my writing, I'm always trying to do a little bit of teaching.
All right. So you settled in New York to get back to the trajectory of your career, and you're writing for a soap opera.
I did that.
How long did you work on Capital?
I only worked for two segments, which were 26 weeks, I guess. I did it, you know, to make money, frankly. I mean, it was fun. But the writers were in New York and the production was on the West Coast, so there was a little time lapsing, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, I realized that, you know, I really wanted to write more serious stuff for the theater. It was about that time I wrote a play about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. And so I eventually found myself out of a job and back to trying to get plays produced, which I did. And then I took a one of the things I enjoyed a great deal was I left New York after 10 years, and I went and was the director of the theater school at the Walnut Street Theater in Philadelphia, which is the nation's oldest continuously operating theater. So that was great. I got to have my plays produced there, and also I was teaching playwriting and screenwriting and acting, directing, and being in a major regional theater. So that was a terrific way to leave New York. And it allowed me to have my children not in New York City, which I didn't really want to raise them there. So that was a helpful move that I enjoyed.
Well, was it in Philadelphia where you decided to write a musical about Pat Conroy's first book?
That actually came out of my first play was called The Freak, and it's about this psychic Edgar Cayce, who has a foundation located still today in Virginia Beach. A very exciting story and man, and holistic medicine has sort of caught up with him. He died in 45, I believe, but so he was sort of active in the 20s and 30s and 40s. But anyway, a composer and lyricist came to see that play, and then they approached me, Andrew Croswell and Lee Pockris, who, by the way, I love the fact that I, you know, was writing with Lee had written Johnny Angel. And not to be topped, but the itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini. So I was like, wow, I'm writing the person who wrote those. This is great. Anyway, they had the rights to Pat's book. And they wanted to make a musical out of it, and they saw my show, and they thought I would be a good person to write it. So it actually started way back in the 80s. It reached its sort of apex in the early 90s when we did it at Ford's Theater, and George and Barbara Bush came. And they also invited John Major and his wife, who were visiting in town. So, and the producers didn't even tell me. I was just driving down for the last show, and I'm getting close to Ford's Theater, and I can't go there because of the traffic and what's happening and everything. And then, oh, the president's at your show. So that was fun. And to finish with that, one of the most satisfying and wonderful things I had, especially being from South Carolina, about the Pat Conroy connection is that a couple of years ago I directed a production in Beaufort, his hometown, and it was maybe a year, I guess, after he passed. But so Cassandra King came, and Pat's brother Tim, and a couple of his sisters, and his daughter Susanna. And so we had a whole sort of wonderful get together there, and they, you know, of course, the story is about Pat's life and teaching on Dufusky Island. So that was, it was just terrific. And one of the special memories I have of my career is that on closing night, Sandra King handed me his widow a card, and it was bulky or something, and I was driving away from Beaufort the next day, and I hadn't opened it, and so I opened it in the car with my wife driving everything, and she had a little note about, you know, how much she'd enjoyed the show, et cetera, et cetera. And then she said, this is one of the pens that Pat wrote with. She had given me one of his pens that I only give to special people. So I thought, oh, wow, this is great. I have Pat Conroy's pen.
And I hope you still have that.
I do. I save it to her.
Okay. Let's get back to you in Greenville. You're 9 or 10. You're playing Lions Club baseball. Growing up in Greenville, doing something like that, did you ever hear Shoeless Joe Jackson?
Never. That's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. Is because I thought, this is curious and outrageous, really, that the greatest natural hitter of all time, one of the most famous baseball players ever, while I was growing up playing baseball, nobody ever told me he lived right across town in Brandon Mill. He had passed in 1951 by the time I was playing, but he was alive when my brother was playing, also for the Lions. But all through my youth, I mean, through Exeter, Princeton, I don't think I even learned that he was from Greenville until after college, which amazed me. One of the things I took out of growing up in segregated Greenville was a sense of injustice of all sorts, but obviously about African Americans in those days. And I think that sort of seeped into my soul. I've always been drawn to stories about people who have suffered injustices. And I believe that Joe Jackson is in that category. So that's what really drew me to him, the story, not just that he was from Greenville and hadn't, and because he was a, quote, cheater, no one in that Bible-belted town in those days would even mention his name or tell kids that he was there or someone who should be looked up to or anything like that.
Well, the Greenville in which you grew up was segregated in several ways. Yes, the African-Americans, but I doubt very seriously if your part of town dealt with folks in the Mill Village on a personal basis very much.
No, absolutely not. No, never met them.
There was one high school, Parker High School, where most of the Mill kids went, and had you stayed there, you'd have gone to Greenville High.
That's right.
Okay, so when did you decide to work on Shoeless Joe? You did a screenplay first, right?
Yes, after my Dusky Sally, my play about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, I thought, you know, I need to write a screenplay so I can have at least a sample script to go to Hollywood with. So I thought, wow, The Shoeless Joe is a great story of injustice, and he's from my hometown. And so that's when I started doing most of the research and wrote the screenplay. And then, you know, as happens with many writings, it didn't get picked up in Hollywood, so I put it in a trunk. And then, I don't know, 5 years ago or something, I thought, wow, you know, I love this story. I think I'll just make it into a novel if I can't get a movie made out of it.
Let's move on to the novel, but let's first talk about Shoeless Joe. He is now recognized in Greenville, which I think is significant. In fact, the house where he lived is a museum right next to the baseball stadium there.
It is.
So he's been rediscovered in the 21st century, where he was ignored for 50 years. And certainly, he died almost anonymously.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and also there's a statue of him, which they have moved to outside Fluor Field, the minor league ballpark there. So, yes, it's great that they're acknowledging him and they have this museum. And one of the wonderful things that I did when I was writing this was sit in his chair in his living room and think, wow, you know, I'm sitting where Shoeless Joe sat and looking at the walls he looked at.
Okay, well, let's tell our listeners the story of Shoeless Joe Jackson. Born in Pickens, his family then, like a lot of others, moved off the farm. His father was a sharecropper. Mm-hmm. People don't think of white sharecroppers, but in South Carolina, in the upstate, there were a lot of white sharecroppers.
Absolutely.
To Pelzer, which was a mill town, and then the outskirts of Greenville, where his father worked at Brandon Mills. You had not been in a mill until adult life.
Right.
And you want to describe that experience for our listeners?
Well, part of my research was to actually go inside a textile mill. And so I went, I forget the name, it was on the outskirts of Greenville now. It's still there. Anyway, I arranged to go there and have a tour of the mill, and they gave me these headphones, somewhat like what I'm wearing now in the studio. And I went inside, and there are these huge machines making an unbelievable amount of noise. And even through the protective earmuffs, it was just incredibly loud. It's an experience. I guess if some of the listeners have seen the movie Norma Rae, you can kind of hear the sound there because they are able to do the sound. And it was just, I couldn't believe people would work in Joe's day 12 hours a day in this. He started at age 6 or 7 working 12 hours a day in a textile mill.
And it was not climate, it was not climate controlled.
No.
And lint was everywhere.
Lint was everywhere. One of the startling facts I learned that I put in the novel was it was so thick that you couldn't see the clock on the wall. So if the superintendents or whoever needed to communicate things to everybody, like it was time to leave or, I mean, they did have the mill whistle, let them know that, but it was like a fire drill or a break or something. They used a series of lights because everyone could see the lights. And the workers inhaled so much lint that sometimes they would vomit up balls of cotton. That image just is startling to me.
And as you point out, Jackson, at the age of 6 or 7, when most kids were going to school, mm-hmm. not most in South Carolina, but some kids were, and he became a mill hand.
Yep. And
again, 12-hour shifts.
12 hours.
Eventually, South Carolina would get a child labor law, which would cut down that shift, but it not by much.
To 8 hours. And they only had two, I think even under the 8-hour shift rule, they had two 10-minute breaks and one 20-minute break. That was it. And they stood on their feet on these floors. That was the other thing. I mean, the machinery, the floors were trembling. And, you know, you did not want a thread to break because you were paid by the pick, which is how many times the loom went across and came back. They had pick counters. And so if it broke, you had to quickly learn how to tie a weaver's knot as quickly as you could. But workers loved it when it was really humid inside because, and even over 100 degrees, but humid because that meant the threads would be less likely to break.
And of course, they like children to do that because they were more agile and less likely to get their hand caught in the machinery.
Yes, there were a lot of injuries by machine. People would definitely lose body parts. And hair, I read one story about a woman who got her hair caught in the machine, like ripped all her hair out of her scalp.
By the time Jackson was 13, he began to play for the Mills baseball team. And then we can get into a whole subject that most folks don't know about, and that's the textile leagues. But it's interesting that the mill owner approached his mother about asking him to play or getting him to play for Brandon Mill.
Yeah, she had the power to make the decision.
He was paid. I think that's he was paid $2.50 a day on Saturdays. That's more than an adult made in the mills for a day's work.
Absolutely. No, they paid the ball players very well. The mill owners, they, you know, it was, as we've said, such a hard life that they were looking for ways to make it more pleasant. And baseball came along in the 1880s and 90s, and it was actually introduced by Civil War Northerners into the South after the Civil War in the waning days of it. But it was the perfect thing to distract the workers and to get them interested in something and to sort of bond them to the mill team, I mean the mill life. So they went to great lengths to hire really good ball players, and they would give them the easiest jobs. They would just give them a screwdriver or something and, you know, tell them to go out and check on machines once in a while. But they mainly got them to for their baseball playing skills, and they paid them well.
We need to pause for a moment, let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Granville Weish Burgess about his book, The Last At-Bat of Shoeless Joe. All right, Granville, back to the mill owners and the textile leagues. The competition, there were actually formal leagues by World War I. There was actually the Textile League, there was the Greenville League, and there were leagues all over the Southeast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the people at Brandon Mills saw that there was a good player over at Pelzer, they tried to hire him away.
They did.
And as you pointed out, sometimes they just hired a good player, not necessarily to work in the mills, but he had to be on the payroll in order to be able to play in the Textile League.
Right. He had to be bona fide, they said.
Yes.
He had to be a bona fide worker.
Now, we always think about Jackson as an outfielder, but he started off as a pitcher.
He did, and then he broke some batter's arm. Because he threw so hard, and then they were reluctant to bat against him after that.
He became already at a young age a legend in the textile leagues, and there had been somebody who had gone just before him, Champ Osteen, who was another textile mill player that made it in the big leagues. Both men moved from mill to mill, each trying to get a little bit more money.
Right.
And he did pick up his nickname, Shoeless Joe, in Greenville.
He did. He always hated that nickname because it made him feel like a rube and a hick and, you know, like he didn't have the money to buy shoes. But the real story is that he had bought some shoes in downtown Greenville, and he was trying them on for the first time, and they hurt his feet terribly. So he simply took them off, and then he hit a long ball to right field, I believe, and as he was rounding third base, somebody in the stands yelled out, "Run, you shoeless son of a bitch," and that stuck because I'm having a senior moment here. The writer for the Greenville News, I've forgotten his name at the moment. Anyway, that's how he got his nickname.
Well, you mentioned he didn't like being thought a rube. But he was an uneducated man. He never had any formal schooling.
Right.
I found it fascinating to learn that somebody says, "Oh, I've got a Shoeless Joe autograph." Well, the chances are it's not really a Shoeless Joe autograph.
No, he couldn't read or write. And he used to, he carried in his pocket a something that had written out. It said, you know, best regards, Joe Jackson. And when he was asked for an autograph or something, or a signing program, he would pull that out and he would just painfully copy the letters in his hand. And no, I think I read somewhere that there's only one baseball with his signature on it, and that went for like, you know, $78,000, you know, 5 years ago or something. But yeah,
yeah, his wife signed for him.
Yeah, his contracts.
His contracts. Well, he began his pro career in Greenville, and Connie Mack from Philadelphia, the town you love, signed him to play with the Philadelphia Athletics. And he didn't his first couple of years in the pros, he wasn't too happy.
No, it amazed me. He went up there and he didn't like it because they teased him. I have this scene in the book where they are at a restaurant with his teammates, and there's a finger bowl for washing your fingers in front of his plate, and they told him it was some magic elixir that would help your sex life or something like that, and he was supposed to drink it up. So he did, and they're laughing at him like crazy, and these kinds of incidences happened, and he just got back on the train and went to Greenville. And so Connie Mack had to send somebody back down there to get him, who convinced him that, listen, career is going to be totally over if you don't come back. So he did. And then he left again later. So he didn't really want to go to the North and play baseball, at least not with Philadelphia.
Yeah. And so he moved to, I never heard of the Cleveland Naps. I think they became the Indians. What was the Nap? What was the Naps for?
You know, I don't know what it was for. I'd never heard of it either. Yeah.
That's where he really hit the big time.
In Cleveland, yes.
In Cleveland. And you can correct me because statistically, I think his rookie season, his batting average was higher than any. It still stands as a record for a rookie.
A rookie, yeah. I think it was 4.11 or something like that.
4.08.
4.08. Yeah, I think Teddy Ballgame, Ted Williams, was the last person to break 400 way back when. Yeah. No, the man could hit. It was unbelievable. He had these. In those days, it was a dead ball era. So they didn't hit these towering home runs the way they do today with a livelier ball. And so what hitters did was they hit what Joes were called blue darters because they went so fast, supposedly they looked blue. But they mainly hit line drives in between the fielders to get their home runs. They didn't hit them over their heads. But yeah, he was an amazing hitter. Babe Ruth, you know, modeled his swing on Joe Jackson's because he said, this is the best swing out there, and that's what I'm going to copy.
He then moved on to the Chicago White Sox, and they won the series 1 year, and then we come to the infamous incident of the Black Sox.
Right. It was 1917 when they won. Anyway, yes, the Black Sox scandal, the throne World Series of 1919. Charles Comiskey, the owner of the Chicago White Sox, was not beloved by his the people he hired, the ballplayers, to say the least. He was a chintzy man. He alone among the owners, for instance, made the players paid to do their own laundry. So they just to launder their own uniform. So they stopped laundering them. They weren't going to do it. And so anyway, they got dirtier and dirtier. And I think that's why they were called the Black Sox even before the scandal, because of the dirty uniforms had nothing to do with the dirty scandal. So in the World Series of 1919 against the Cincinnati Reds, as I said, the ballplayers hated Comiskey, and they didn't like the way he wouldn't give them decent salaries. And even though he was raking in the money, because after World War I was over, baseball really, you know, was very popular again. In fact, in the World Series that we're talking about, there were 9 games, not the 7 that we have today, because the owner said, oh, we'll just have a couple more games, we'll rake in more money. So Eddie Seacott and Lefty Williams got in cahoots with these gamblers, professional gamblers. Gambling was rampant in those days. Boxing, horse racing, even baseball. people bet on everything, how many strikes would be thrown in an inning or anything. So it wasn't that unusual for gamblers to be around ballparks, and they would already be paying players, like, for inside dope, like who's sick or, you know, who has a sore arm or whatever, to help them in their betting odds. So Eddie Cicotte and Lefty Williams and Chick Gandeel, the first baseman, conspired with these gamblers. Abe Rothstein was the New York gambler, sort of in charge of it all, to throw the World Series. And it was really bungling because they never really could, except for the pitchers who were Lefty Williams and Eddie Cicotte. I mean, how do you throw a series if you're just a regular ball player? But anyway, the pitchers did succeed in throwing it. But they also, to make the deal, they told the professional gamblers that Joe Jackson was in on it. But when Chick Gandeel asked him to go in on it before the deal was, you know, sealed, as it were, it was never signed, he refused twice. And as I said, gambling was, you know, rampant in those days. And so there were all these rumors flying around the World Series that the fix was in. In fact, everybody knew it so much that the odds for the White Sox winning kept going down and down. And the gamblers who didn't get their bets in early enough, they really took a bath. They didn't make the money they thought they were going to make. So Joe Jackson says, no, I don't want anything to do with this. And Chick Gandeel tells the gamblers he's in on it anyway because he's the most famous player on the White Sox, and he figured that would shore up their end of the bet. And so when Shulis hears about the fix being in, he goes to Kid Gleason, the manager, and says, listen, bench me for the series. You know, I don't want anything to do with this, and the only way to stay clean is to not play at all. And, you know, Gleason asks Comiskey, and Comiskey said, are you kidding me? You're a best ball player. Forget it. You know, there's no fix. You know, don't worry about it. The fans love you. You will be safe, et cetera, et cetera. So he played. And he had he batted 375, which is the highest average of the World Series. He hit 12 hits, which was a record that stood until 1964. He threw out a man at the plate. He threw out five or six runners. He hit the only home run. He made no errors. And this was obvious, I think, to anyone, that he did not play to lose. He played to win. As I say, record-setting series. The pitchers did manage to lose the games, and they lost the series. Chicago did 5-3. And Charles Comiskey, the owner, also knew that the fix was in because he had investigated. In fact, 3 days after the series ended, he sat down, he and his, not he personally, but his Cary Grabina and others in his organization with a gambler who told him all about it. And he hired private detectives. So on one hand, he was denying the rumors. On the other hand, he already knew that it was true. Everybody hoped it would just go away, and it did go away until some gambler spoke up and talked about it in a way, and it was in the newspapers, and now Comiskey couldn't deny it anymore. So then he switched and offered a $10,000 reward for any information about the fix. He did this even though he already had all the information because he'd hired a private detective, et cetera, and talked to gamblers and knew it. Which he never rewarded that $10,000 to anyone, by the way. So in the 1920 season, near the end of the season, the Chicago White Sox were also in the pennant race, and the newspaper articles came out, and a grand jury was summoned, and Eddie Cicotte decided to go testify in front of the grand jury. You know, they were deciding whether to indict these ball players, eight of them on the team. Eight Men Out is a book and a movie that was also made about the scandal. And what happened to Joe was that he got summoned to the office of Alfred Austrian, who is the lawyer for the Chicago White Sox. But he didn't tell Joe that he was also Charles Comiskey's personal lawyer. So Joe thought he was talking to the team lawyer who would be advising him well. And Austrian advised him to go in there and tell the truth, which his truth was that he was in on the fix. And Joe was like, but I wasn't in on the fix. And he said, listen, if you go in there and say that you weren't in on the fix, it's not going to do you any good. No one's going to believe it. And think about this, Joe. The gamblers are not going to be too happy because they thought you were in on the fix. And they are not very good at forgetting things like this. And so he was actually worried about his safety and mainly the safety of his wife, Katie. So he took Austrian's advice and went in there. And the newspapers called it a confession. He never said he confessed. He never used the word confessed. And if you read the transcript, you will see that he both says, yes, I did it for the money. And he also says, no, I played my heart out. I would never do it. So it's a very confused, quote, confession. And guess what? There was no law against conspiring to throw a game in Illinois. There was no law about gambling about it. And after only 3 hours of deliberation, the jury came back and said, hey, these 8 ball players are innocent. But because of the potential scandal about it and because the owners were so worried about the image of baseball and losing all the fans and all their money, they had previously hired a new commissioner of baseball, a judge named Mountain Kennesaw Landis. And part of the deal he made with the owners was, I have to have absolute power or I'm not going to take this job. So they gave it to him. So Joe and the other 7 are declared innocent. And the very next day, Landis issues his edict. And the edict starts with these amazing words, regardless of the verdict of juries. I'm like, regardless of the verdict of juries, I'm going to say what the law really is.
I mean, this is coming from a judge, right?
Yeah, from a judge. It's just like you want to scream with the injustice and the irony of it all. Anyway, he goes on, no player who throws a ball game, no player that undertakes or promises to throw a ball game, no player that sits in conference with a bunch of crooked players and gamblers where the ways and means of throwing games are discussed and does not promptly tell his club about it will ever play professional baseball. And that edict is why Shoeless Joe Jackson was banned during his life and is still banned from being in the Hall of Fame, from ever being involved with professional baseball.
Supposedly, at the turn of this century, Commissioner Bud Selig was saying that Jackson's case was under review.
It should be under review. And, this is another terrible irony of Joe's life. In the last year of his life, 1951, in February of that year, the South Carolina legislature passed a resolution urging the commissioner of baseball to disavow the ban, or whatever the right words are, to unban Shoeless Joe. And it was proceeding along, and 10 days before he died of a heart attack on December 5th, 1951, he was scheduled to go on Ed Sullivan's show, The Toast of the Town, I think it was called. So there was going to be all this momentum to get him into the hall, but he died. And that stopped it. But yes, it's been visited from time to time. But the Shoeless Joe Jackson Museum actually wrote to the current commissioner, Rob Manfred, and asked him about it too, as recently as I think 2015. And he just wrote back and said, no, there's no reason to do it. You know, let the past stand. We don't have any new information that will, give me the cover, really, what it is to overturn this decision.
Hey, we got to keep things clean. Steroid ball, right?
Yeah, right. Oh, my goodness.
Hey, even with that, they can't produce the kind of play that Joe Jackson did.
No, they cannot. No one ever. He's the greatest hitter there ever was in baseball, in my humble opinion. All and right. It's so unfair what happened to him. Yeah. And Walter, may I just say that not only was he declared innocent in one trial, but he sued Comiskey for back pay, $16,000. And so they went to trial in 1924, and Comiskey actually had to testify, and Austrian had to testify, et cetera, et cetera. And this jury awarded him the $16,000, and you know, and said he was innocent as he did that. And this judge turned around and threw Shulis in jail for perjury, because what Alfred Austrian had gotten him to do when he talked to the grand jury back in 1920 was to sign a waiver of immunity. Of course, he knew Joe couldn't read it, and he wouldn't let him take it to Katie to read. Oh, there's no time. You got to go down and testify right now. And so the judge said, hey, you testified in 1920 this way, and now you're testifying in 1924 this other way, and that's perjury. Off to jail with you, Joe Jackson.
So did he get to keep the $16,000?
No, he did not. Oh. He did not. So he's declared innocent twice, and he's still banned from baseball to this day. I just go crazy with the injustice of it all.
Okay. Well, Joe retires home to Greenville.
Yeah.
And he runs a liquor store.
Mm-hmm.
Did he really get involved with youth baseball as happens in your novel?
Not as specifically. I think he wanted to coach a minor league team, but the baseball wouldn't let him in the 40s. So I think he was more of a sort of a mentor to people who would come up and go into some of them made the major leagues and thanked him for teaching them. But no, he didn't do what he does in my novel, which is coach a mill team.
Well, he still kept his favorite bat.
Black Betsy, yes. Give him Black Betsy, the fans would shout when he would come to the plate.
How many bats does a professional player have today? I mean,
oh my gosh. Yeah, he kept this one bat. And he would pick up bobby pins and put them in the back of his pocket for whatever reason. That was one of his superstitions. But Black Betsy, he would wrap in a towel and take down in the South during the winter because he didn't want it to get cold up there in the North.
Okay, let's talk about your book now and the story of the young folks there. We'll not reveal the ending. And by the way, it's almost an O. Henry ending, I'll just say that.
Thanks.
So if you've got a favorite passage, have you got the book with you?
I do.
The book is set in the 1950s.
Yes.
It's post-World War II. The textile leagues are in their last stages.
So there's a young ball player, Jimmy Roberts, who is talented and wants to escape the soul-killing life of a textile mill worker. So he goes to Shulis in his liquor store and says, Mr. Jackson, please, will you coach me so I can get out of here and go play professional baseball just like you did? And Shulis, in my novel, is very bitter about what baseball had done to him, and he basically says, you know, no kid, no way. But his wife sort of encourages him to do it, and he's sort of sneaking out and watching baseball all the time anyway from far away through binoculars. I mean, he loves the game, but he just won't admit it to himself. But he finally decides that, you know, it's because of Jimmy being treated unfairly in an incident in the book that Shulis says, you know, wow, I feel the same way, the way I was treated unfairly. So he says, I'm going to help this kid.
Okay. Now, how was Jimmy unfairly treated?
He was fired from his job. There's a sort of a crusher. Goodlett is this ball player who tricks Jimmy into messing up a game, and the, quote, evil mill owner of the rival team, Howard Stone, who is a Yankee who hates being in the South. His father gave him this textile mill, and he can't wait to get out, and he thinks because of his connections in professional baseball with the Yankees, if he can produce a winner, he'll have a chance to buy a team up north and get out of Greenville. Crusher hires Crusher to play for him, and Crusher tricks Jimmy into losing this ball game by making a bonehead play, and Howard Stone fires him, so he's out of a job. And so that's what sort of helped Joe say, you know, wow, I feel just like I know how he feels, so I'm going to help him. So he takes this misfit team and of ball players who are in last place, and he teaches them. I really love some of the things that I learned about what how Shulis taught himself and what he learned about baseball. One of the things he used to do was to he spent hours. He would cover one eye and stare at a candle, and then he'd cover the other eye and stare at a candle. I mean, he could see the ball. He called it, in my book, he calls it seeing things true, which I hope is a metaphor for the whole book. But so that when you can see the spin on the baseball, it's more, you'll know how to hit it. So he teaches Jimmy to see things true, and Jimmy teaches the whole team to see things true. And he also would hold a bat out. And Black Betsy weighed 48 ounces, which is not light. I think Ty Cobb's bat weighed 39. So at the end of your arm, just as long as you can to build up the muscles in your arm, and just various drills, like he would make them, you know, hit 20 balls at third base and they had to throw it to second and first and not make an error, or else they had to start all over again. A lot of baseball scenes that were fun to write. Anyway, so he makes this team into a championship contender, and Howard Stone is in danger of not winning the championship and not being able to escape. So he puts in motion a plan to, to separate Jimmy from his hero emotionally. And he uses the trial transcript of, Joe's supposed confession to do it. But then we go to the final game, and which we won't say what happens in his last at-bat. So my novel, anyway, it's a heartfelt story of a young boy and his hero, and it uses the history of what happened to Joe in a series of flashbacks that impact the ongoing action in the present tense. So I'm happy that people have really enjoyed it. Some people, and they're even moved by it. People have written me. That's one of the nice things about doing something like this is you get to hear from people you don't know, and they like your work, and that's always satisfying.
What's next for you?
Well, I'm going to follow through on this Common Ground. I'm doing a reading of it this fall, trying to find a theater that will produce it. And my wife was raised Amish Mennonite, and in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And so a few years ago, I ran across an article in the Wall Street Journal and something that said that Amish romance publishing was like 20% of the market or something absurd. And so I got this bee in my bonnet through her cousin. It started as a joke about how my wife's relatives, sort of, since I'm a divorced man, were like thinking that she was going to go to hell for marrying me and things like that. So I was going to sort of joke back at her. But anyway, it turned into this trilogy I'm writing, the Rebecca Zook trilogy. So I've written two of the books. So next is to write the final one. Stone in the Crick, Fork in the Crick, and the last one's going to be called Home in the Crick. Okay. So that's what I'll do. I didn't know this, but in Sarasota, Florida, there is a Mennonite Amish community right there in this town. All these Mennonites and Amish people go there every winter, and they dress in black and ride around on bicycles, et cetera. So that's going to be the setting of book three.
There is a Mennonite community in South Carolina as well.
That's right.
So,
maybe.
Okay. All right. Granville, I hate this. Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign.
Oh.
any last words for our listeners before we sign off?
Just would like to say that I hope if I think they would like this book because if they share any of the sense of injustice that I have spoken about, you know, we would love to have more and more fans of the idea that Shoeless Joe deserved to be in the Hall of Fame, and what happened to him is outrageous and needs to be fixed. And hopefully maybe reading this novel would give them an urge to join in that movement.
Okay. Well, Granville Weiss Burgess, I want to thank you for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. It was fun connecting with Granville Weiss Burgess. His story, to me, is as interesting as the story of Shoeless Joe. It's about South Carolina boys who go on to make good somewhere else. Growing up in Greenville, Granville Burgess never heard of Joe Jackson. He was an embarrassment to the community. He's been resurrected, and now he's a local hero. Correcting the injustice of what happened to Shoeless Joe Jackson, it's one of the reasons that the author wrote this book. It's a story of American history, the national pastime, baseball, but it's also very much a South Carolina story. It's a part of our history here in the Palmetto State. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.